their Yankee Doodle hats. But on the other hand, they're saying they're security for a march protesting reductions in government benefits, which seems pretty liberal to me. It's a puzzler, I agreed. I don't know, Davidson said. Maybe it's not about politics. Maybe these guys are just assholes. Seems the simplest explanation, I said. We have a right to assemble, Washington Swope began, clearly winding himself up. Oh, Jesus, don't, Van said. It's too early in the fucking AM for your brand of pathetic patriotic bullshit. Washington Swope clammed up, surprised. Better, Van said, and leaned in toward the lot. Now, your threeps are here, but each of your physical bodies are in a different state. That makes you the FBI's problem, which means you are my problem. And I say five jackasses dressed up like the back of a $2 bill, claiming to be a militia and waving around rifles in a goddamn Georgetown coffee shop, violates Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code, Chapters 26, 43, and 102. I quickly pulled up the relevant chapters of Title 18 and noted that Chapter 43 was for false personation. I didn't suspect that anyone would confuse Swope with the real George Washington. I also knew to stay quiet. So here's the deal, Van continued. You have two options. The first is I decide not to make a federal case of it, and you idiots walk your threeps over to the precinct storage room where you power them down, and then we yank out the batteries. You'll have 3 days to arrange to have your threeps and your precious rifles shipped back to you, or we'll assume you're donating them to the Metro Police. The second option is I do make a federal case out of it, in which case we confiscate your threeps and rifles, and a law enforcement official comes to all of your houses to wheel you off to the nearest hating-capable federal detention center, which is probably not actually anywhere close to you. Then you get the joy of spending all the money every single member of your entire family will ever earn on lawyers, because in addition to those three chapters of Title 18 I covered with you, I'm going to throw every other single thing I can think of into the indictment. That's bullshit, said Thomas Paine, a.k.a. Norm Montgomery of York, Pennsylvania. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't, Van said. But whatever it is, I will absolutely fucking bury you in it, and I will enjoy it, because you chose to waste my time making me deal with you. So, decision time. Door number one or door number two? Choose wisely, and if you don't choose in 10 seconds, we're going with door number two. Choose. 7 seconds later, our founding fathers chose door number one, and Davidson was yelling for an escort to walk them down, one at a time, to evidence and storage. Then we moved on to the next Hayden in the pen, this one in for punching some woman who called her a clank. Welcome to the next 4 days, Van said to me as we exited the 2nd District headquarters. We've got a bunch of incarcerated threeps in the 1st, 3rd, and 6th District to get at, too. Then, when we're done with all those, we can come back here to the 2nd and start all over, and then over and over again until the march is done and all the Haydens go home. You should probably tell your caregiver to put you on a caffeine drip. What about Johnny Sonny and Loudon Pharma? I asked.
Terrorism's got Loudon Pharma, Van said. We're only on the edges of that one. Sonny's in our morgue and not going anywhere. Both of them can probably wait until Monday, unless you think you've got something.
I think I have something, I said. Maybe.
Maybe? Van said. We don't have time for maybe at the moment. We've got a whole line of threeps that we have to decide what to do with.
I want someone to look at Sonny's neural network. We've already got our forensics people looking at it. I want someone looking at it who knows their way around one, I said. Someone who works on them every day.
You have someone in mind? Van asked.
My new housemate, I said. Van reached into her jacket pocket for her e-cigarette.
You're getting an early start on your cronyism, she said.
It's not that, I said, annoyed. Johnny Sonny had an IQ of 80. He had no business having an integrator's neural network in his head. Someone installed it in him, and someone used him. And then, when they were done with him, they made him slit his own throat somehow. I think there's something going on in the software of that network.
Something that forced him to slit his own throat? Van said.
Maybe, I said.
There's that maybe again, Van said. She sucked on her cigarette. Tony does neural network software all the time, I said. And he contracts with the companies who make them to test their security and troubleshoot issues. He would know what to look for, or at the very least, he would be able to see if something was wildly off. And Tony, in this case, is your new housemate. Yes, I said. He's done confidential work for the government before. Has a vendor ID and everything. Is he expensive? Van asked. Does it matter? I asked. Of course it matters, Van said, and it was her turn to look annoyed with me. One of us is going to have to make the case for any expenditures we make outside ourselves, and if they don't like it, they're going to yell at me to yell at you. I think it's going to be worth it, I said. Van took another suck on her cigarette. Then, fine, let's get him in. I'll tell them it's related to the Loudoun Pharma thing if they bitch about it. And they'll buy that, I said. Maybe, Van said. Because I really do think there's something going on there, I said. I recounted to Van my brainstorming session of the night before. Do you do that a lot? Van asked, after I finished. That tossing things into space and drawing lines between them thing? When I can't sleep? Yes. You need to find some other evening activities, Van said. I'm not even going to touch that one, I said. Van smiled wryly at that, took one more suck on her cigarette, and then started to put it away. Well, I don't want to take a run at Lucas Hubbard if we don't have anything to take a run at him with. If we come after him, I want him off guard. We can ask after Cassandra Bell, but I guarantee you the terrorism people already have a microscope shoved up her colon after the Loudoun Pharma thing, so she may not want to speak to us, and terrorism might not want us stepping on their dicks even if she does. What was the name of that woman integrator that Schwartz was using? Brenda Rees? I'll knock on her door today, Van said. See if anything shakes loose there. Am I not going with you? I asked. No, Van said. Since you seem to think all this is on some sort of timetable, you need to go out to California to follow up on that money order and then head over to that City of Hope place to see if anything comes of that. That should keep you busy. What about Tony? I asked. Give me his information and I'll get him set up and over to the morgue today, Van said. If he's a flake, I'm going to take it out on you. He's not a flake, I promise. He better not be. I'd hate to have to kill him and frame you for it. That reminds me, I said. Me threatening to kill someone reminds you of something? Van said, surprised. We haven't known each other that long, Shane. I had a run-in with Detective Trin last night, I said. Really? Yeah. Among other things, she implied that you drove your former partner to attempt suicide. Huh, Van said. What else did she tell you? That you have high work standards for other people, but not yourself. That you're sloppy, a little bit dangerous when it comes to procedure, and that you have various addictions that are either the result of or the contributing factor to you washing out of the integrator core. Did she tell you I set puppies on fire, too? Van asked. She did not, I said. It may have been implied. What do you think? I don't think you set puppies on fire, I said. Van smiled at that. I mean the things Trin actually said. This is my third day with you, I said. You ride me hard, which I don't mind, by the way. But then you do stuff like you did in there, where you let a bunch of assholes with firearms slip away rather than charge them with assault. If they did lawyer up, the fact that you threatened them with false personage wouldn't have helped your case any. You caught that, Van said. I did, I said. So maybe that qualifies as sloppy. I do notice that you smoke a lot, and when we talk after 6 p.m., you always seem to be in a bar looking for someone to screw. As far as I can see, it doesn't affect your work, and your free time is your own, so I don't actually care, aside from thinking that basting your lungs with insect poison is a bad idea in general. Do you think it has to do with my time as an integrator? I haven't the slightest idea, I said. I don't get the feeling you're in a rush to tell me about those days, which tells me something really fucked up probably happened way back when. But either you'll tell me when you want to or you won't. The same with whatever the hell is going on between you and Trin, because clearly she's got a bug up her ass about you. That's an interesting way to put it, Van said. It's the only thing Trin said that I worry about, I said. She thinks you're going to fall apart on me, and that when you fall apart, you're going to end up taking me with you. And what do you think about that? Ask me after the march is done, I said. Maybe I'll have an answer for you then. Van smiled again. Look, Van, I said, if you promise me that you're not going to fall apart on me I'm going to believe you. But don't promise me that if you're not going to be able to follow through. If you can't promise, that's fine. But it's something I want to know up front. Van paused for a moment, looking at me. Tell you what, Van said, finally. When this weekend is done, you and I will sit down somewhere, and I'll have a beer, and you'll do whatever, and I'll tell you why I stopped being an integrator, and why my last partner shot herself in the gut, and why that asshole Trin has it in for me. Can't wait, I said. In the meantime, I'm not going to fall apart on you, Shane. I promise. I believe you, I said. Well, good, Van said, and took out her phone to look at the time. That's settled, then. Now, come on, we have two more district houses to hit. I thought I was going to California, I said. No one's going to be around until 9 a.m. out there, Van said. That's still a couple hours away. Let's see if we can punt a bunch more troublemakers back home before then. One of the threeps in the first district holding cell is there on a drunken disorderly. I want to hear how that happened. Chapter 15. I looked around, and I was in an evidence room in the FBI offices in Los Angeles. An FBI agent was looking at me. Agent Shane? She asked. That's me, I said, and started to get up, which is when I encountered a small problem. I can't move, I said, after a minute. Yeah, about that, the agent said. Our actual spare threep is being used by one of our local agents. Her regular one is in for some maintenance. The only threep we had available for you was this one. It's been in storage for a while. How long is a while, I asked. I found the diagnostic settings and started running them. I think maybe 4 years, the agent said. Maybe five? Could be five. You're letting me use a threep that's evidence for a crime? I asked. Isn't that, I don't know, tainting the chain of possession? Oh, that case is over, the agent said. The owner of that threep died in our detention center. How did that happen? He got shivved. Someone shivved a Hayden? I said. That's pretty cold. He was a bad man, said the agent. Look, I realized I had not gotten the agent's name.
Agent Isabel Ibanez, she said.
Look, Agent Ibanez, I said. I don't want to appear ungrateful, but I just ran a diagnostic on this threep and its legs don't work at all. There appears to be significant damage to them.
It's probably because the threep got hit with a shotgun blast, Ibanez said.
A shotgun blast, I repeated.
During a firefight with FBI agents, yes, Ibanez said.
The owner really must have been a bad man.
Pretty much, yes.
You understand that having a threep that can't move its legs is going to be a hindrance to the work I need to do today, I said. Ibanez stepped to the side and then motioned to the wheelchair she had previously been standing in front of. A wheelchair, I said.
Yes, Ibanez said.
A threep in a wheelchair.
Yes, Ibanez repeated.
You understand the irony, right?
This office is ADA compliant, Ibanez said.
And as I understand it, you are going to a post office, which are also required by law to be ADA compliant. This should be sufficient. You're actually serious about this, I said.
It's what we have available at the moment, Ibanez said.
We could rent you a threep, but that would require approvals and paperwork. You'd be here all day.
Right, I said.
Would you excuse me a moment, Agent Ibanez?
I disconnected from the wounded threep before she had a chance to say anything else. 20 minutes later, I stepped out of an Avis office in Pasadena with a shiny new maroon Cayman Zephyr threep I had rented out of my own pocket, got into the equally maroon Ford I had also rented, and headed toward the Duarte post office. Take that, paperwork. The Duarte post office was an unassuming box of beige bricks with arches at the windows to give it a vaguely Spanish air. I went in, stood in line politely while three separate old ladies got stamps and mailed packages, and when I got to the front of the line, displayed my badge on my threep's chest monitor to the postal clerk and asked to see the postmaster. A small, older man came to the front. I'm Roberto Juarez, he said. I'm the postmaster here. Hi, I said. Agent Chris Shane. That's funny, Juarez said. You have the same name as that famous kid. Huh, I said. I suppose I do. It was one of you, too, he said. A Hayden, I mean. I remember that.
Must be annoying for you sometimes, Juarez said.
It can be, I said.
Mr. Juarez, about a week ago, a man came into your post office to get a money order. I was hoping to talk to you about him.
Well, we get a lot of people asking for money orders, Juarez said. We have a lot of immigrants in the area, and they send remittances back home.
Was this an international or domestic money order?
Domestic, I said.
Well, that will narrow it down a little, Juarez said. We do less of those.
Do you have a picture?
Do you have a tablet I could borrow for a second?
I asked.
I could display the picture on my chest screen, but it turns out people feel uncomfortable staring into your chest. The postal clerk, whose name tag listed her as Maria Willis, gave me hers to use. I signed in and accessed the picture of Sonny, cleaned up, eyes closed, and showed it to them.
It's not the best picture, I said.
Juarez looked at the picture blankly. Willis, on the other hand, put her hand up to her mouth in surprise.
Oh, my God, she said. That's Ollie Green.
Ollie Green? I repeated the name, as in Oliver Green, and like the color. Willis nodded and looked at the picture again.
He's dead, isn't he? She asked.
Yes, I said.
Sorry.
You knew him?
He would come in every week or so to get a money order, an envelope, and a stamp, Willis said. He was nice. You could tell he was a little slow.
She looked at me to see if I understood the implication.
But a nice man. Would make small talk if you let him and there wasn't a line.
What would he talk about? I asked.
The usual things, Willis said. The weather, whatever movie or TV show he'd seen recently. Sometimes he'd talk about the squirrels he saw on the walk here. He really enjoyed them. He once said he'd like to get a little dog who could chase them. I told him if he did that, the squirrel and the dog would end up getting run over.
He lived nearby then, I said, if he was walking over to the post office.
I think he said he lived at the Bradbury Park Apartments, Willis said. Bradbury Park, Bradbury Villa, something like that.
I immediately did a search and found Bradbury Park apartment homes about half a mile away. Next stop, then.
Did he ever talk about his work? I asked.
Not really, Willis said.
He mentioned it once, but then said what he was doing was confidential, so he couldn't talk about it. I didn't think much of it at the time. I thought he was trying to make a joke.
Okay.
I don't think he liked his job, though, Willis said.
What makes you think that? I asked.
The last few times he was in, he didn't seem really happy, Willis said. He was quiet, which was unusual for him. So I asked him if everything was all right. He said the job was getting him down. He didn't say anything else other than that.
All right, I said.
And now he's dead, Willis said. Did that have anything to do with his job?
I couldn't really say at this point, I said. We're still looking at things. Juarez cleared his throat. I looked behind me and saw two new little old ladies waiting. I nodded to him in acknowledgement.
Looks like I need to wrap up, I said.
Anything else about Oliver Green that sticks out in your memory?
He asked about a post office box one of the last times he was here, Willis said.
Wanted to know how much one was and what he'd need to get one. I told him the price and that he'd need two forms of ID. He seemed to lose interest after that.
I told him he'd probably be better off with a security deposit box anyway.
Why?
Because he said he had something he wanted to put somewhere safe.
Oliver Green, said Rachel Stern, the Bradbury Park Apartments manager.
Nice man. Rents a one-bedroom ground floor near the orchard and laundry room.
Well, he doesn't rent it directly. His company does. I looked up at that. His company.
Yes, Stern said. Filament Digital.
I don't know that I've heard of it, I said.
They do something with computers and medical services, I think, Stern said.
I'm not really sure. I know they do a lot of work with City of Hope, which is why they rent the apartment from us. So the people they have working there will have a place to stay.
So Mr. Green isn't its first tenant, I said.
No, there have been a few before him, Stern said. Most of them have been fine. One, a couple of tenants back, we had to tell to keep quiet after 10 p.m. He liked to play his music loudly.
But not Green.
No, Stern said.
Model tenant. Traveled a lot, especially recently. Hardly knew he was there.
She looked puzzled for a moment.
Is Mr. Green in trouble with the FBI for something?
Not exactly, I said. He's dead.
Oh, my God, Stern said. How?
Miss Stern, would it be okay if I looked at Green's apartment? I asked, changing the subject.
Sure, Stern said. I mean, if he was alive, I suppose you would need a warrant, but now that he's dead...
She trailed off for a moment, apparently trying to decide how to proceed. Then she nodded to herself and turned to me. "Of course, Agent Shane. Come with me." She motioned me out of the door of her office. "This is a nice complex," I said to her as we walked, mostly to make chit-chat and to keep her from thinking about whether she really should ask for a warrant. "It's all right," she said. "We have nicer complexes elsewhere. This one is in the middle of our portfolio. But Duarte's a nice little town, I have to say." "Agent Shane, do you mind if I ask you a question?"
"Go right ahead," I said.
"Are you related in any way to Sienna Shane?"
"I don't think so," I said. "Is she somebody famous?"
"What? Oh, no," Stern said. "I went to high school with her in Glendora, and when I got back to our 10-year reunion, she said a cousin of hers got Hayden's. I thought maybe it might be you."
"Nope," I said. "I'm not even from here. I was born in Virginia."
"Why did you ask me if she was famous?"
"When people ask you if you know someone, they're often someone famous," I said. "That's all."
"I can't think of anyone famous named Shane," Stern said, and then pointed at an apartment. "Here we are."
I looked up and then grabbed her arm.
"Hold up a second," I said.
"What is it?" Stern asked. I pointed at the apartment's patio. Most of it was hidden by a privacy wall, but the top of the sliding glass patio door was visible. It was open, just a crack.
"Does Green have roommates?" I asked quietly.
"Not on the lease," Stern said.
"Was the patio door like that before?"
"I don't think it was," Stern said. I reached for my stunner to flick the clasp on my holster, and then realized I was wearing a rental threep.
"Shit," I said, looking down at where my stunner wasn't.
"What is it?" Stern said.
"You have your phone on you?"
"Yes."
"Stay here," I said, and then pointed to the apartment door. "If I don't come out of that door in exactly 1 minute, call the police, then get back to your office and stay there. Got it?"
Stern looked at me like I had just turned into an octopus or something. I left her, went to the patio wall, and heaved myself over it, landing as quietly as possible on the bare patio. I crouch-walked over to the patio door, turned on my recording mode, slid the door open enough to slip through, and entered the apartment. I stood up. A matte black threep was there, standing in the dining nook, 20 feet away, an envelope in its hand. We both stared at each other for a good 5 seconds. Then I closed the patio door behind me and locked it. I turned back to the threep. "FBI," I said. "Freeze." The other threep bolted for the front door. I went after it, leaping over a couch to do it, and collided with the threep about 3 feet short of the entrance, ramming it into the wall. The drywall cracked but held. The threep tried to hit me in the head but had no leverage. I grabbed it and heaved it, sending it stumbling back between the living room and dining nook. The envelope it had in its hand fell to the ground. "You're under arrest for breaking and entering," I said, walking toward the threep in an arc to keep it from thinking about trying for the patio door. "You're also under arrest for assaulting a federal officer. Give up now. Don't make this more awkward than it already is." The threep fainted toward the door and then headed into the kitchen, which was dumb because it was walled in on 3 sides. I came around to the open side. The threep looked around, saw a set of knives in a butcher block holder, grabbed one, and held it at me. I looked at it, and then looked at the threep.
"Are you kidding me?" I said.
My threep's body was carbon fiber and graphene. A knife was going to do dick to it. The threep flung the knife at me, and I flinched involuntarily. It pinged off my head and back onto the kitchen floor. When I came back up, the threep had pulled a large pot out of the pile of dirty dishes in the sink and aimed it directly for my head. There was a gonging sound as it connected, twisting my head aside and caving in a portion of it. It was then I realized that my rental threep's pain receptors were dialed up really high. Some part of my brain recognized this made sense, since the rental place wanted to keep its customers from doing anything stupid with the threep, and dialing up the sensation of pain would certainly do that. The rest of my brain was going, "Ow, Jesus, fuck, ow, ow." The threep raised its arm back for another swing and brought it down again. I made a fist and punched the pot as it came down, and then shoved myself into the threep, driving my elbow into the threep's neck as I did so. That's what I wanted to do anyway. What I ended up doing was a lot less kung fu and a lot more drunken scuffle. But on the other hand, I managed to push the threep backward and make it stumble, which was the point. On the stove was a skillet with the remains of some scrambled eggs in it. I grabbed it and looked back at the threep, who was back up, pot in hand. "Come on," I said, "are we really going to do this?" The other threep spun the handle of the pot in its hand, waiting. "Look," I said, "the police have already been called. They're on their way. You might as well..." The threep went high with its pot and swung down heavy. I backed up and stepped to the side, avoiding the pot. The threep's arms came down, leaving its head exposed. I smacked my skillet into it like I was a tennis player returning a volley. The threep fell back flat on its ass. I took advantage and kicked it in the side as it tried to scramble back up, sliding it farther back and to the right into the kitchen. Its right arm, the one holding the pot, was splayed out. I drove my legs into it, immobilizing it, pushed the body to the stove, driving the other arm under the threep body. I raised my skillet. The threep looked at it, then at me. "Yeah, I know, a goddamn skillet," I said. Then I drove it into the threep's neck, edgewise, 7 or 8 times until the carbon fiber casing cracked. Then I reached over and picked up the knife from the floor and slid it under the cracked casing until I could feel the tip resting against the bundle of control fibers that went from the threep's processor to its body systems. "See, this is how you use a knife in a threep fight," I said, and then hammered the knife on its handle with the skillet. The knife severed the bundle fibers. The threep stopped fighting me. I wedged the knife in and cracked open the neck a little more, looking in until I could see the cord that carried power from the battery back to the processor in the head. I reached into the neck and wrapped a finger around it. Then I looked at the threep. "I know you're still there, and I know you can hear me," I said. "And I know this threep can still talk. So why don't we do this the easy way?" I looked around at the mess. "Well, the easier way, anyway. Tell me who you are and why you were here. I have your threep. I have its onboard memory. I'm going to find out all of it sooner or later." The threep said nothing. But whoever had been controlling it was still there, still looking at me. "Have it your way," I said, and yanked at the power cord, feeling it rip away at one of its terminals. The threep was now officially dead. I stood up and looked around the apartment. It looked like a couple of idiots had trashed the place. I went to the door and opened it and saw Rachel Stern on the phone, gawking at me.
"I heard noises," she said. "I called the police."
"Excellent idea," I said. "Call the FBI's L.A. office while you're at it. Tell them I need an entire crime scene team and whoever they've got handling technology forensics. Tell them the sooner they're here, the better."
"Are you okay?" Stern asked, looking at my threep's head.
"Well, let me put it this way," I said. "I don't think I'm getting the deposit back on this threep." I turned away from her and wandered back into the apartment. On the floor was the envelope the threep had dropped. I picked it up. It was a plain white envelope on which the words "For Grandma and Janice" had been written in very large, not terribly adult writing. The envelope was sealed. I debated for a moment and then opened it. On the inside was a data card.
"Hello," I said.
A call pinged into my field of view. It was Claw Redhouse.
"Agent Shane," I said.
"So, Chris, this is Officer Redhouse," Redhouse said.
"I know," I said.
"You know that thing you're investigating?"
"I do," I said.
"Well, I have some people here who want to talk to you about it."
"Important people, I would guess."
"That would be a good guess," Redhouse said. "They wouldn't happen to be at your desk with you at the moment, would they?" I asked.
"Actually, yeah," Redhouse said.
"How could you tell?"
"The nervous stammer, mostly," I said. There was a little laugh on the other end.
"You got me," he said. "Anyway, these people were hoping they might get to talk to you today."
I held up the data card to get a closer look at it.
"I think that can be arranged," I said. "I have people there I want to talk to, too."
Chapter 16.
"Tell me you have video of your fight," Van said to me when I got back into the office.
"I'm fine," I said, coming around to her desk. "Thanks for asking." I didn't ask because I knew you were fine, Van said. You were in a threep. The worst that could happen is you get a dent. That's not the worst that could happen, I said. My last moments in the Los Angeles area consisted of handing my insurance information over to a very annoyed manager at the Pasadena Avis so they'd deal with the threep I had brought back with a cracked and dented head. You survived, Van said. The other threep got it worse, I allowed. And do we know who the other threep was yet? Van asked. No, I said. The L.A. forensics team is looking at it now, but when I was looking at it, I didn't find any make or model information on it. Which is weird, Van said. It's very weird, I said. Every commercial threep carries that information by law, along with a vehicle identification number. I raised my arm to show where my threep's number was etched, just below the armpit. There was none of that. Theories? Van asked. One, it's a prototype model, I said, something that's not on the market yet. Two, it's a market model with aftermarket modifications, including stripping off make and model numbers and the VIN. Three, it's a Ninja. Ninja Threep, Van said, that's funny. It wasn't so funny when it was trying to bash my head in with a pot, I said. The L.A. team said they will let me know when they find something. I told them to pay special attention to the processor and memory. They looked at me like I was an asshole. No one likes to be told how to do their job, Shane, Van said. I'm not hugely impressed with the L.A. office, I have to tell you, I said. But maybe they're trying to put me in a threep in a wheelchair set me off a bit.
A fleeting memory of a very annoyed call from Agent Ibanez, who waited 10 minutes for me to return before figuring out I was gone for good, surfaced in my memory.
I won the argument when I pointed out that if I had showed up at the Bradbury Park Apartments in a wheelchair, our mystery threep would be long gone, and with important evidence, which reminded me about the evidence. I need to go back to Arizona this afternoon, I said. Random shift in conversation, but okay, Van said. It's not random, I said. Johnny Sani left a data card for his sister and grandmother. It's what the Ninja Threep was there for. It's got data on it, but it's password protected. Whatever password Johnny Sani is going to think up is not going to be that difficult to figure out, Van said. Probably not, but it will still be easier to ask his family first, I said. Pretty sure it was meant for them. I made a copy of data. I need to take the copy to them and see if they know what to do with it. Are you going to ask them if they know why Johnny was living under an assumed name, too? I will, but I don't expect they're going to know, I said, and thought about it a bit. What's weird is that Oliver Green doesn't seem to have any ID either. What do you mean? Van asked. When I was talking to the lady at the post office, she said that Sonny wanted to rent a P.O. box, but when she said he'd need two forms of identification, he lost interest, I said. And the apartment wasn't rented by him. It was rented by Filament Digital. He didn't need any ID there, either. What is Filament Digital? It's a component manufacturer for neural networks, I said. It's a Chinese company. I called and no one answered. It's the middle of the night over there right now. They don't have a U.S. office? Van asked. As far as I can tell, that apartment was the U.S. office, I said. I have the L.A. office looking into that, too. The L.A. office must love you right about now, Van said. I don't think I'm their favorite person, no, I said. What have you been up to? I cleared out some more of the Haydens from Metro's holding pens, Van said. Most of them took the get the hell out of D.C. option, but there were a couple who didn't and a couple who really needed to be prosecuted, so they're all now guests of the federal government for the next few days. We'll deal with them after the march. The Metro people tell me things are getting a little tense out there. Oh, and I shook up that integrator. Which one, I asked. Brenda Rees? Yeah, her, Van said. I called her up and identified myself and said that I would like her to come meet with me to answer a couple of questions. She asked why, and I said we were following up on the Loudoun Pharma explosion. Then she asked why I'd want to talk to her about that, and I told her we were just following up on an anonymous tip. We didn't get any anonymous tip about her, I said. No, but it made her nervous when I said it, which I thought was interesting. Anyone would be nervous if you told them you were following up an anonymous tip about a bombing by talking to them, I pointed out. What's important is how they get nervous, Van said. Rees got all quiet and then asked to meet this evening. We bring her here? I asked. I gave her the address of a coffee shop I like in Georgetown, Van said.
Feels less formal, and we'll get her to relax and open up. So first you make her paranoid, and then you want her to feel comfortable, I said. You don't need me to help you play good cop, bad cop. You can do it all on your own. This is the sort of thing your pal Trin calls sloppy, Van said. I'm not sure she's wrong, I said. If it works, she's wrong. That's a dangerous philosophy, I said. Van shrugged. A call popped up in my field of view. It was Tony. You didn't tell me I would be working in an actual morgue with an actual brain when I took this gig, he said, after we got our greetings out of the way. I had to be circumspect until you were vetted, I said. Sorry. It's all right, Tony said. I've just never seen a real-life brain before. Also, I had to dial back my sense of smell pretty much down to zero. Have you found anything, I asked. I've found a lot of things, Tony said. I think maybe I should talk to you about them. And your partner, too, probably. Let's meet, I said. Not in the morgue, Tony said. I think I need to get away from all this meat. Okay, here's the first thing, Tony said, and he popped up the image of Johnny Sonny's brain, still in its skull, peeking through the veil of tinsel that was the neural net. We were in the imaging lab, me, Van, Tony, and Ramon Diaz, who seemed amused at Tony taking over his imaging console. It's a brain, Van said, and... It's not the brain I want you to look at, Tony said. It's the neural network. Okay, Van said. What about it? It's totally unique, Tony said. I thought every neural network was unique, I said. They adapt to the brain they're in. Right, but every model is the same before it's installed, Tony said. He pointed at my head. The Raytheon in your head is the same as every other version of that model. Once it's in your head, the tendrils and receptors are placed in ways that will be unique to your brain, but it's still the same hardware and the same initial software. Van pointed at the network on the screen. And you're saying this one isn't any of the current commercial models out there? I'll go further than that, Tony said. This doesn't match any model ever created. All neural networks have to be submitted to the FDA for approval, or to the matching agency in other countries. All submitted designs are pulled into a single database for those agencies to use, and for people like me to use for reference. This design isn't in the database. So, it's a prototype, Van said. We don't put prototypes into people's brains, Tony said, because they're prototypes and they might kill you if they screw up. We model them extensively on computers and animals and specially cultivated brain tissue before they're approved. By definition, if it's in someone's brain, it's a final design. He pointed at the network. This is a final design, but it's not in the database. Can we see the network without the blood and gore? I asked. Tony nodded. The image of Sonny's head was wiped away, replaced by a wireframe representation of the network. I didn't have time to pretty up the model, Tony said. That's fine, it all looks like spaghetti to me, I said. Then why did you want to see it? So I didn't have to look at someone's head all opened up, I said. Right, Tony said. Sorry. You said this isn't any version you've seen before, Van said. That's right, Tony said. Well then, does it look similar to any you've seen before? Van asked. Every car maker I know of has a house look. The same thing might apply for neural networks. I thought of that, Tony said. And what I see is that whoever made this took a lot of design choices from existing models. The default filament spread looks very much like a Santa Ana model, for example, but then the juncture architecture is pretty much a straight ripoff from Luckturn, which is the accelerant company I was telling you about this morning, Chris. He looked at me for acknowledgement. I gave it. And there are lots of other little touches that come from other manufacturers, past and present, which maybe tells us something. What is that? Van asked. I don't think this is meant to be a commercial model network, Tony said. It's a really good neural network. It's really efficient and elegant, and just from the design, I'm guessing that the brain network interface is really clean. But, I said, but that's because this brain is a lot of best-of-breed architecture from other existing designs, designs which are patented to hell and gone, Tony said. He waved at the image of the network. If someone tried to put this design on the market, they'd get their asses sued by every other neural network manufacturer out there. This thing would be in litigation for years. There's no possible way this would ever get to the market. None whatsoever.
Does it matter if it's a network for an integrator? I asked. It's such a tiny market relative to the Hayden market. You could argue that it doesn't represent a commercial threat. Not really, Tony said. There's no real difference in the architecture of a Hayden network and an integrator network. The major difference is how they array in the brain, because Hayden and integrator brain structures are different, and in the software that runs the network. So why make it? Van asked. Why make a network you can't sell? That's a good question, Tony said. Because the other thing about creating a neural network is that it's not something you're going to do in your spare time at home. The first functional neural network ever made cost $100 billion to research and develop. The costs have come way down since then, but it's a relative thing. You have to pay for simulations and testing and modeling and manufacturing and everything else. He waved at the network again. So this will still have set someone back somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion. $1 billion right down the hole, Diaz said. Right, Tony said. He seemed a little surprised that Diaz was still there. And that's the thing. You don't spend $1 billion on a neural network you can't sell. You especially don't spend $1 billion now. Because up to now, Hayden research costs were heavily subsidized by the government. Abrams Kettering ends that. The Hayden population in the U.S. is less than 4.5 million, almost all of whom already have networks in their heads. Even if this architecture were legally viable, it still doesn't make sense to spend that much money because the market's already saturated and the number of new Hayden's cases that pop up every year in the U.S. won't get you into the black. Even worldwide, you'd have a hard time with it. It's a boondoggle, I said. It really is, Tony said. As far as I can see, anyway. Maybe I'm missing something. Let's look at it from the other side, Van said. What do you mean? I asked. Let's stop asking why someone would do this for now, Van said. Let's ask who could do it. If we have some idea of who could do it, then maybe we can come back around to why they would do it. So, who could do it? Lucas Hubbard could do it, I said. $1 billion isn't nothing to him, but he'd have to lose several billion before he would seriously feel it. Yeah, but you're describing every owner of a Hayden-related company, aren't you? Tony said. We threw a shitload of money at Hayden's because the First Lady had it. Hell, Chris, that old picture of you with the Pope probably kept Hayden funding rolling for a year or two. I'm no big fan of Abrams Kettering, but one thing they weren't wrong about was that Hayden's funding's become a long trough a bunch of piggies are feeding from. Hubbard's one, so's Kai Lee, who runs Santa Ana, so are about 20 other people in the C-suites of these companies. Any of them could have funded something like this without it hurting them. Yeah, but Hubbard's got a connection to Sonny, I said. The dead guy, Tony said. I nodded. What's the connection? Accelerant owns the company that's licensed to provide healthcare to the Navajo Nation, Van said. And Sonny's Navajo. It's not a really great connection, is it? Tony said after a moment. Working on it, I said. Hubbard wouldn't want to toss $1 billion away at the moment anyway, Tony said. Accelerant is trying to merge Metro with Sebring Warner and might just try to buy it outright. If he does that, a cash payout is going to be part of that deal. You're strangely well-versed on the business dealings of Accelerant, Van noted. I keep up with all the companies I do work for, Tony said, looking over to her. It's part of how I know which clients are going to have work for me. And what I know right now is that all the companies in Hayden-related industries are getting ready for the crash. They're either merging or buying each other outright or trying to diversify as fast as they can. Abrams Kettering's knocked over the trough. It's done. So we're saying that even if Hubbard or Lee or anyone else could fund something like this, they wouldn't, I said. Not right now, Tony said. That's my guess. I mean, I'm not an FBI agent or anything. Who else is there then? Van said, looking at me. It was apparently time for a test again. I thought about it for a minute. Well, there's us, isn't there? I said. The FBI? Diaz said incredulously. Not the FBI, but the U.S. government, I said. $1 billion wouldn't matter to Uncle Sam. And it's possible we'd build something we wouldn't commercially exploit, either for pure research or just because it's pork for some congressperson's district.
So we have this developed in some NIH institute as busy work, Van said.
The U.S. government has been known to pay farmers not to plant crops, I said. No reason that principle couldn't go high tech. I turned to Tony. And maybe that's why it's not in the registry, since it was never intended to be commercial.
That's great, Tony said, but it still doesn't explain how this, he gestured at the network, got into someone's head.
Working on it, I said again.
Work harder, Tony suggested. What about the software, I asked. I've only glanced at it, Tony said. I was going to get to that next, but I thought you might not want to wait for a hardware report. From what I can see, it's programmed in Chomsky, which makes sense because that's the language designed specifically for neural networks. The software's got substantially fewer lines of code than most integrator software I've seen, which means it's either really efficient or that whoever programmed it only wanted it to do specific things.
When will you be able to tell us which it is? Van asked.
I should be able to give you a general report this evening, Tony said. If you want more specifics, you'll need to let me take the code home with me tonight.
That would be fine, Van said.
I should tell you that when I work in the evening, I get time and a half.
Of course you do, Van said, just as long as you have an early report ready for us by 7.
Can do, Tony said.
And you, Van said, looking at me,
you think you'll be back from Arizona by then?
I should be, I said.
Then fly, Shane.
Fly.
Van walked off, reaching into her jacket for her e-cigarette.
Chapter 17. In the offices of the Window Rock Police Department is a conference room. In the conference room today was a display with a password-protected video file waiting to be opened. I was also in the room. So were May and Janice Sani. Claw Redhouse and his boss, Alex Laughing, sat across from the two women. Standing in the back of the room were Gloria Roanhorse, speaker of the Navajo Nation, and Raymond Vicente, its president. It was the last two who had been making Redhouse jittery when he spoke to me earlier in the day. It's one thing to have your boss breathing down your neck about a case. It's another thing to have the two most powerful people in the Navajo Nation doing the same thing. I glanced over to Redhouse. He still didn't look entirely thrilled to be in the room.
I don't know any password, May Sani was telling Redhouse. Janice doesn't either. Johnny never told us any passwords.
We don't think he did, Redhouse said. We think maybe he wanted to give it to you, but then he died before he could do it. But we do know he wanted the two of you to see this, so maybe the password would be something that meant something to you, or something only the two of you would know.
Janice looked over to me.
You couldn't just break the password? She asked.
We didn't want to do that, I said. It would be disrespectful to Johnny and to the two of you. If you want, we can try, but it might take a long time. I agree with Officer Redhouse here that before we try doing that, you should take a few guesses.
When people make passwords, they sometimes use the names of family members or pets, Redhouse said, and went over to the keyboard that was wirelessly connected to the display. For example, May, he typed in the word. It came up wrong. Or Janice, Redhouse said. That one also came up blank. Any pets?
We had a dog when Johnny was a boy, Janice said. His name was Bentley. Our mom named him.
Redhouse tried it. It came up blank. Several combinations of the three names likewise came up uselessly.
We'll be here all day, Roanhorse whispered to Vicente, who nodded.
Did Johnny know any Navajo? I asked. Did he speak or write the language?
A little, Janice said. We were taught it at school, but he didn't do very well in school.
He loved the stories about the code talkers, May said. The ones from World War II. There is that old movie about them that he used to watch when he was a boy.
Wind talkers? Redhouse asked.
I think so, May said. I didn't like watching it. Too much blood. One year for his birthday, I got him a code talker's dictionary. He would read that a lot.
I pulled up a Navajo code talker's dictionary online. It had several hundred words in it, a number of categories, including names of airplanes, ships, military units, and months.
Tasosi, I said. Everyone in the room looked at me strangely.
What did you just say? Redhouse asked me.
T
Tasosi, I repeated. I just looked up the Code Talker's dictionary. The month of May is Tasosi. I'm aware I'm pronouncing it terribly.
You really are, Red House said, smiling.
Johnny called me that for a little while after I gave him the book, May said.
It's worth a shot, I said, to Red House. He typed it in. The file opened.
May, Janice, President Pacenti said. Do you want to see it alone first?
No, May said. She reached over to her granddaughter, who took her hand.
Stay.
Red House hit the keyboard again to play the file. And there was Johnny Sani, alive to me for the first time.
Hello, Grandma. Hello, Janice, he said, staring into the lens, which he held close to his head so that it obscured most of the background. I think maybe they can hear what I do on my phone, so I went and bought a camera. I'm going to hide this for now, so if something happens to me, you'll find it. I think there's something wrong with me. I think maybe something they did to me is making me sick. You remember I went in to look at a job for a janitor. After I did that, I got a call from someone who said he was a recruiter for another job, said that it would pay really well. He said to go back to the computing facility and that there would be a driverless car waiting for me. All I would have to do is tell it my name, and it would take me to my job interview. So I did, and the car was there, and I told it my name. The car drove me to Gallup, to a building where a threep was waiting for me. He said his name was Bob Gray, and that the job would be acting as a personal assistant for an important man. I asked them what that meant, and he said it mostly meant running errands and taking him to places he wanted to go. He said I would get to travel and see the world and it would pay well, and all that sounded good to me. I asked Bob why me, and he said it's because I was special in ways I didn't even know about. Then he gave me $2,000 in cash and said that was the first week's salary right up front. And I could keep it, even if I said no. He said the job paid cash, so I wouldn't even have to pay taxes on it or nothing. Well, I took the job right then. Bob said that the CEO liked his privacy, so I shouldn't tell people anything, but that I got a job, so I did. And then, after I said goodbye to you, the car drove me to California. Bob met me and showed me my apartment and said it was mine now. Then he gave me some more money. The next day, Bob took me to meet my boss, who was named Ted Brown and who was also a threep. He said that as his assistant, I would become an integrator, which is someone who took people places in his head. They would need to put a computer into my brain for that to happen. I was scared at first, but they told me it wouldn't hurt, and that Ted would only need me to do it every once in a while, and the rest of the time I could do what I wanted. But because my job was secret, they would have me use a code name, named Oliver Green. They took me to a doctor's office, and I went to sleep, and when I woke up, they had cut all my hair off my head, and said that they had put a computer into my brain. I had headaches for the next few days. They said it was the computer getting used to my brain. They said it would take a couple of weeks for it to get used to me. When that was done, Ted and Bob came over and said it was time to try integrating. Ted said that he would come over into my brain and move my body around. I said okay, and then I felt a little sick, and then my arm moved by itself. That scared me. But Bob told me to relax and not to worry. Then Ted walked my body around my apartment for a while. After that, Ted would use my body a little bit every day. We would go to the store or the library, and once he even mailed a money order for you at the post office. And I thought, this isn't so bad. I just had to remember to relax. We did this for 3 months. I asked him when we would travel, and he said soon. And then it started to happen. One day I was watching a show and I blinked and the show was over and another show was on. And I thought, I must have fallen asleep and not even known. Then the next day I put a burrito in the microwave and pressed a button to start it. And I blinked again and it was dark outside and the burrito was cold. I could tell I cooked it because stuff leaked out of it, but it was done cooking for so long that it got cold again. It started to get worse. I would be doing something, and then I would be somewhere else, doing something else. I would put on one shirt, and then another shirt would be on me. I once went to put on a show that is on TV on Monday, and it was Tuesday, and it was morning, not night. I didn't tell Ted about it because I was worried I would get fired if he knew I was sick, but I finally got so scared that I had to tell him. He sent me to the doctor, and the doctor said I was fine, and that sometimes people who were integrators had what he said were dropouts. He said they would stop, and that when they did, I would get my memory back. I tried not to worry, but it kept happening. Then one day I looked up, and I was in a group of men I didn't know, and one of them was talking to me, and I had no idea what he was saying. Then he said something about killing someone. I don't remember the name. He asked me a question, and I didn't know what he was talking about, so I stayed quiet and didn't do anything. And then one of them said, he lost the connection, and another one said shit, and then another one asked if that meant the other guy was in the room. I was pretty sure he meant me. I just stayed quiet and did nothing. And then it was the next day. Bob came by to ask me how I was doing. I lied to him, and I said I was fine. I think I figured it out. I thought I was having dropouts because they put the computer in my head. But I think it's really that Bob and Ted are using the computer in my head to give me dropouts. The thing is, the dropouts are getting longer now. The last one, I lost 3 whole days. I don't know if I can do anything about it. I thought about trying to run away, but I have a computer in my head now. I know they will find me, and they can make me drop out anytime they want. And I think when they drop me out, they use me to do bad things, or they are going to make me do bad things. I don't know what to do now. I'm making this so if you find out that I've done something bad, you'll know it wasn't really me. You know I wouldn't do that. I don't know if I can stop them from using me to do something bad, but I promise you, if I can, I will. All I wanted was a job. I wanted to give you someplace nice to live, Grandma. And you too, Janice. I'm sorry. I love you.
The picture wheeled from Johnny Sonny's face, showing the interior of his bedroom in Duarte. Then it went blank.
Who in goddamn hell does something like that? Vicente said. It was fair to say he was fuming.
By this time, May and Janice Sonny had left the conference room distraught. Captain Laughing had escorted them out, motioning to Red House that the conversation should continue in his absence. President Vicente did not need any prompting.
"Is that actually even possible?" Red House asked me.
"To black someone out and then control their body?" I asked.
Red House nodded. "I've never heard of it ever happening."
"That's not the same thing as it not being possible," said Speaker Roanhorse.
"No, ma'am, it's not," I said.
"But if it was something that was possible, it's surprising that it hasn't been done before. Neural nets are built to be resistant to hijacking," I said, and paused.
"What?" Red House asked.
I briefly debated what to tell them, but then thought, screw it, this is the Navajo Nation's leadership. I wasn't blabbing to just anyone.
"The neural network in Johnny Sonny's head is one of a kind," I said. "It's entirely possible it's fine-tuned for something like this.
It would make him a unique case. Why him? Bassetti asked. Why do this to Johnny Sani? Anyone else leaves a trail, I said. Johnny Sani never left the Navajo.